Hello and welcome to Weird in the Wade, a podcast about all that's weird, wonderful and a little off kilter in the town of Biggleswade in Bedfordshire. Each episode, I'll tell you a tale of something strange and unique that has happened in this most English of market towns or its surrounding area. There's an older meaning to the word weird, which means to twist and turn. In Norse myth and in Anglo-Saxon times, this came to mean fate or destiny, all that was and is and all that is yet to be. Whether it's tales of ghosts or flying saucer hoaxes, the big cat of Biggleswade, or the pot and poisoner, curious social history, or the great swan mystery of 1935, we'll follow all the twists and turns and uncover fascinating stories that will speak to you today, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Weird in the Wade. December the 8th, 1826, 1 a.m. The snow was falling heavily now, covering the freshly dug earth of his father's grave with a soft, white shroud. Joseph Cooper's horn lantern cast a pitiful light, and the surrounding graveyard was becoming less distinct. The tombs softened by a veil of snow. Only the old twisted yew tree remained dark and untouched, as if from some inner heat it kept the snow from settling. Joseph Cooper could barely keep his eyes open. He was sitting on a box he'd brought with him 2 days ago. He had barely moved in those 48 hours. He'd stayed awake for most of that time, only napping when he had company during the day. A gun rested across his stiff knees. He wasn't even sure if it would fire in this cold temperature. He wondered if a dagger would have been better protection. He wasn't afraid of keeping vigil in the graveyard. He wasn't afraid of the dead, at any rate, not at first. He was still too angry. But as the hours wore on, his sleep-deprived mind began to fray and unravel. Joseph's wife, Hannah, had pleaded with him to come home. In her opinion, it was all rumour and gossip, and the town was feverish with fear about these resurrection men. But Joseph knew there had been body snatchers in Dunstable in recent weeks. Some spoke of a broker, a dealer in the dead, making his way up the Great North Road, then sending the bodies he plundered back down to London. It was said that this shadowy king of the resurrectionists was in the Catherine Wheel pub this week, whispering with the young lads of Biggleswade who drank there. Joseph's chin rested on his chest, heavy, weary. He jerked his head back, upright, furious at drifting off to sleep momentarily. He would not allow anyone to steal his father's body and cut it up like meat. He thrust his shoulders back, shook his head. His father had been a strict man, but fair. A man who Joseph could laugh with once he had left home and had a family of his own. But most of all, his father had been a God-fearing man. A man who knew his Bible and tried to live honestly and simply as the Lord taught. He didn't deserve to be defiled after death. No honest person did. The fancy folk in the big towns and cities could afford mort cages to stop these despicable resurrection men. They placed these heavy iron cages over their loved ones' graves. But in a town like Biggleswade, the likes of the Coopers could not afford such precautions. Eventually the snow stopped, and a kind of muffled hush fell on the graveyard, Joseph thought how he must resemble a ghost himself, sitting there, still as the dead, cloaked in a white film of ice. He shook his head and shoulders clear of the stuff. He stood up from his box, stamping his feet to get some feeling back into them. Then he froze again. He'd heard a rustling, possibly a small animal. His movements had disturbed, but it sounded loud, distorted. Then a water bird called from the river that flowed just behind the church. He still didn't move. He listened for any crunch in the snow, any muffled noise. Nothing. He relaxed a little, turned his mind over the gossip he'd been told, how this blue-eyed Londoner, dressed smartly, something of a military bearing about him, had arrived at the Catherine Wheel on Monday, sitting in the shadowy corners of the inn with the shadiest characters of the town. But then, befriending some of the local lads, the ones who liked to drink, the ones who liked the girls a little too much, the ones who were restless to get away and leave the fields and labouring behind them. It was just a suspicion that this smart, stiff man from London was after something secret, something sinister. He'd been asking about Joseph's father's funeral arrangements. Joseph had told the vicar what he'd heard, and the Reverend listened patiently with a frown on his face. He'd rubbed his whiskery cheeks and told Joseph to not worry about it. He would speak to the constable. But Joseph didn't trust the constable. No, if you needed a job doing, you did it yourself. Then his thoughts were interrupted again, this time by a noise that was indescribable, coming from the yew tree halfway along the path to the church. Its long, thick trunk snaked over the path in a most peculiar angle. He'd never liked walking underneath that tree as a child on his way to Sunday school. Was it a bird that he'd just heard? The noise came again. It was not human, and it was no bird that he recognised. And it was definitely coming from above him. The warning of his wife, Hannah, rang in his ears.
You've told the constable, Joe. Leave it to them. You shouldn't be hanging around a churchyard. Not at this time of year. It's not right. We're approaching Yule. Things are unsettled and unquiet until we get to Christmas. It's not a good time to be out amongst the dead, Joe. It's a witching time of year.
He dismissed it as superstitious nonsense, but as the noise came again and the shadow of the dark yew loomed amongst the white graveyard, he longed to be at home. The clock struck two. He hesitated for what felt like hours, but was just a few minutes. The thought of Hannah, warm in bed at home, was comforting, but the shape of the dark yew crowded in on his thoughts. This was day two of his vigil. Surely the resurrection men would not strike now. He hunched over and looked down at the snow-covered mound of earth beneath which his father lay, and he whispered,
I'm going now, Dad. You'll be all right. I'll be back tomorrow, and every night until this villain has left town or been caught. I promise, Dad. I'll be back tomorrow. Look, I'm leaving my box ready to sit on again on the morrow. Good night, Dad.
He turned slowly and trudged away, his head hung low, but thoughts of his warm bed at the front of his mind. The clouds had thinned, and a brittle moonlight splintered through the yew tree's branches as he walked beside it. He would not walk under it, not tonight. He turned onto the high street and glanced about. Everything was silent and still. No footprints in the snow were visible other than his own. His own footsteps crunched, but the sound was muffled. It made him think of the earth hitting his father's coffin. He walked through the market square and peered at the Catherine Wheel pub. All was dark and silent there. Little did Joseph know that Rawlins, the innkeeper, had only just extinguished the lamps and candles, having been assured earlier in the evening by four of his guests, still awake and in the bar, that he needn't wait up for them. They sat huddled around the glowing embers of the fire, a single candle flickering between them. They were whispering. Rawlins did not like it. Didn't like it one bit. But he was shattered from an extremely busy day of work, and he was due to rise in less than 4 hours' time, so he dragged his weary body up to bed, closing his door and his mind to what those four men were up to that night. Welcome. Welcome to Weird in the Wade. I'm Nat Doig, and on today's episode, we're going to look at more ghost stories associated with crime, criminals, and victims of crime. Our first case is that of the Biggleswade Body Snatchers, a story notorious about the town. And as we'll learn, not all about this story is as it seems. And I believe I've uncovered a far more interesting angle to the story than the murky rumours generally remembered. Then we'll look at a story where it is a victim of crime who haunts a location, and I recorded in that very location that the spirit is said to haunt, Green Park in London. On a freezing winter's dusk, I recorded in the park, telling the strange story of the sorrowful spectre as I sat beneath the park's mournful trees. Before we crack on with the episode, I have some news. First of all, a huge thank you to all of you for listening, and welcome to my new listeners. You are very welcome in this weird corner of the podcasting world. The last episode about ghostly crime had the most downloads in its first week of any of my episodes up until now, so thank you. Do keep telling others about the show and sharing on social media if you can. As always, reviews and ratings on your podcast app of choice always help other people to find the show. And I have a date for your diary. Believe it or not, it's almost a year since Weird in the Wade launched. To celebrate, I'm going to hold a live online event, including a live story and Q&A. It will be held on Wednesday, the 1st of May at 7 p.m. British Summer Time. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And apologies to my Aussie and New Zealand listeners. It'll be the middle of the night for you. I'm sorry, but I will make the event available afterwards. There's a link in the show description to find out more and how to attend. And I'll remind you about it during the next episode too. You'll also find in the show description links to the show social media and the podcast's Ko-fi page, where if you're able, you can buy the podcast a coffee. I'm currently running a special fundraiser because my second piece of news is that in early April, I will be spending the night in not only one of the country's most haunted apartments, but also another night in what is often described as the country's most haunted pub. I'll be by myself and recording for the show. Both venues have got a fantastic history behind them to explore as well. So if you'd like to contribute to my travel costs for completing this challenge, head over to my Ko-fi page to support. All the links are in the show description. Thank you. Now, back to the Body Snatchers. Resurrection Men. Before we head back to Biggleswade, let's have a quick look at what these resurrection men were and what they did. The first thing to say is that disturbing graves appears to have been taboo for a very long time indeed. Think of the Egyptian tomb curses, for example, and the lengths the pharaohs went to hiding their tombs in the desert or placing them deep inside pyramid fortresses. Think of the lengths ancient Europeans went to protect their dead in stone and earth barrow tombs. In many parts of the world, the dead were venerated, ancestors revered, and still are. And Christianity brought to the UK its own rules about death and burial. Yet, sometimes graves were disturbed by those ignoring these rules, by those who felt enough time had passed to make the disturbance less dangerous or unacceptable. The robbing of fresh graves for jewellery and other grave goods and the like could be an issue. Remember the trouble at St Mary's Old Church up on that lonely hill at Clop Hill, way before the black magic stories. Its lonely position, once most services had been moved into the new church in the village, left the graves on the hill targets for jewellery thieves in the mid-19th century. But actually removing bodies, now that seems to be a much more modern phenomena, and our story is tied to a very particular period of time. We're talking about the late 18th and early 19th century, when the science of medicine and anatomy was growing. To train as a doctor, the students needed to understand the human body in all its details, inside and out. Yet there was no legal way to acquire the number of bodies that they needed for dissection and training. Supply was not meeting demand. The 1752 Murder Act allowed for the dissection of execution victims, but there was not enough of them, especially in the 1810s. It's not surprising then that a shady underground trade began in sourcing dead bodies for these doctors at their universities. This murky trade would continue until 1832, 6 years after the incident in Biggleswade, when the Anatomy Act was passed, allowing for those who died and were unclaimed from workhouses, hospitals, and prisons to be used for dissection as well. Universities were issued licenses to procure these bodies. The law was passed in response to some high-profile and repugnant cases, including the Westport murders, as they were known, committed by Burke and Hare in 1828 in Edinburgh, and copycat murders known as the London Burkers in 1831, where instead of stealing recently buried bodies, these men murdered victims to sell to the anatomists. You might remember Wayne from Erie, Edinburgh, mentioning Burke and Hare in the last episode when we talked about Edinburgh's ghostly past. But in 1826, in Biggleswade, it was the fear of grave robbers snatching bodies away for dissection in London universities that had the town in a state of fear. Biggleswade body snatchers, the rumours. Before I tell you what the newspapers of the time reported actually happening back in 1826, I'll let you know what generally gets reported now around the town. Here's some of Biggleswade's hot takes on the body snatchers. There were gangs of body snatchers operating in Biggleswade. They hung out at the Catherine Wheel pub. They used the tunnels to take the bodies from the church to the pub. And the vicar was in on it. In 1970, Boots the chemist moved from the High Street to the site of the old Catherine Wheel pub. The pub had been closed for some years, and its building demolished to make way for the modern Boots building. Sometime earlier, the Woolworths had opened next door, also in a modern building on the site of the old Catherine Wheel pub. The Biggleswade Chronicle ran a short article about this new purpose-built Boots, mentioning that the Catherine Wheel had been the haunt of body snatchers. This wasn't the only time that the story of the Biggleswade body snatchers was covered by local press. In 1943, the Bedfordshire Times ran a diary column about the body snatchers, and in 1958, the Beds and Hearts Pictorial ran a short story-like article about the resurrection men as well. So it's not hard to see why the community have held on to this story. And this knowledge of the body snatchers' activity in the Catherine Wheel pub has led to some stories being shared about the strange atmosphere and goings-on in both Boots and Woolworths in the past. More of these spooky goings-on later. What really happened? However thrilling it might sound to have a gang of body snatchers operating out of Biggleswade, the story also still causes distress for those whose ancestors are buried here. When asking a local Facebook group about what they knew of the story, at least one person got in touch with me, concerned that their ancestor's grave may have been disturbed. I was able to reassure them that that was not the case, but I think it illustrates that the disturbance of graves, even 200 years ago, is an emotive subject still. Currently, the vagueness of the rumours and accepted story mean that the problem of grave robbing can seem bigger than it actually was. And what I have discovered about the body snatchers in Biggleswade is really far more reassuring and exciting in a way than the current rather vague narrative. Firstly, I can find only one case of body snatching in Biggleswade, so the problem was not rife in the town. It appears to have been a one-off. And when you learn how this case was handled by the town, I think you'll see why other body snatchers may have been put off from visiting again. So let's return to December the 7th, 1826. During the day, whilst Joseph Cooper kept his vigil at his father's graveside, others in the town were busy. Two young lads, George Lester, aged 21, and William Smith, 22, were on a series of errands. First, they called at the house of Caleb Maldon, a carpenter.
Hello, Mr. Maldon.
They greeted Caleb in unison.
Morning, George. Morning, Will. What can I do you for then, lads?
Maldon was surprised to see the young men in front of him. They were usually working by the mill or out in the fields, even at this time of year. They weren't the sort of lads sent on errands.
We're after a box,
George said.
Yeah, a trunk,
William squeaked. The one they chose was not a very big trunk, less than 3 feet long.
We need it to be full of sawdust, Mr. Maldon,
George informed.
Really?
Maldon asked, confused.
You have enough of the stuff lying around here, right? It's not a problem.
No.
Caleb Maldon agreed, and the two young men left with a bit of a swagger to their step. They were heading in the direction of the ironmongers, Caleb noted. Once the two lads had left the ironmongers, Caleb wandered over to his friend's shop.
So what did those two daft lads want?
Caleb asked, without checking who was behind the counter. He just assumed it was his friend James. But it was Mrs. Goldthorpe, James's mother, at the counter, and so the response he got was more guarded.
Business is that of yours, Caleb Maldon,
said Mrs. Goldthorpe. She mopped an old rag over some candlesticks.
Sorry, Mrs. Goldthorpe, I thought you were James.
Did you now? My son's out back, but it was I who dealt with those two ninnies. Why do you want to know?
They've just bought from me an old chest, half full with sawdust. I am suspicious of them. Not of you, Mrs. Goldthorpe.
Mrs. Goldthorpe stopped her cleaning. Her pale blue eyes crinkled as she frowned in thought.
Well, that puts a different complexion on it. A trunk from you, a shovel from me, from those two lads who don't have a penny between them usually. And they asked me if I knew the time of the early goods wagon from Carrington's. They're off to see him now. Up to no good, I'll wager. By all accounts, they've been talking with London folk in the Catherine Wheel pub this last week or so, Betsy Albone said. And that Joseph Cooper, he's keeping a vigil at his father's grave as we speak. He says it's going to be interfered with. I just thought he was being an old goose. But I'll call James. You and he go and find the constable. If I tells him what I know, he'll say it's just gossip. But from you, Master Maldon, he'll take it seriously.
If they're up to something, they've not been too bright about it,
Caleb pondered, and he wasn't wrong. Caleb and James found the constable, and all three of them went to Carrington's, the wagon office.
Well, here's a thing,
Mr. Carrington explained.
Those lads, Lester and Smith, were in here just now. They wanted me to carry a trunk of theirs on tomorrow's early coach, so I asked them to bring it to me by 5 p.m. this evening. That they said they could not do. They were mightily disappointed by this, I can tell you. They attempted to strike a bargain. They said they could get the trunk to me by 4:30 in the morning and no sooner, but that they'd pay me more money for my trouble, which to me seemed a likely story. When have those two lads ever had any spare coins? But I let them think that I would carry the trunk on the wagon and I was about to come to you, Constable, and tell you all of this. But you just got here first.
The four men huddled together and a plan was hatched. Before they parted, Caleb asked,
What of Joseph Cooper? He's a simple fellow, but an honest one. Should we tell him?
No,
Carrington explained.
No, he's unsettled enough as it is. I heard that he has borrowed a gun from Isaac the gamekeeper and is to keep vigil there at the graveside tonight still. I thought he was mad, delirious with grief, but it seems he was right. But if we tell him, he will attempt to apprehend Lester and Smith, or worse, and we will have no evidence. Is that not right, Constable?
And the constable agreed. And so Joseph Cooper kept his lonely vigil that night at the graveside until 2 a.m. with no idea that there was a trap set for the resurrectionists. In the Catherine Wheel pub, Lester and Smith were making ready to leave, their companions from London encouraging them to make haste. George Lester had the iron shovel in his hands, weighing it thoughtfully.
Won't the ground be too frozen to dig, though? It snowed heavy this night,
Lester inquired hopefully.
Nonsense, boy. Look, my man Enoch here will go with you to the church and he will help you carry that trunk down to the wagon office. Do as he says and all will go well. You'll have your pay and I'll be on my way back to London.
So the two lads and Enoch, a stooped but broad man who said little, made their way to the churchyard, which they found empty, save for an owl and a fox returning home to his den.
Heh, that fool Cooper. He's left a box for me to sit on, lads. Get busy then. We don't have all night.
Enoch brushed the top of the box with a bony hand and sat on it.
George Lester's teeth were chattering, his legs trembling, not with cold, but with fear of the graveyard, with fear of what they were about to do.
Where's Joseph Cooper gone? I thought he was keeping vigil,
George asked.
Eh, we paid someone to scare him off earlier with monstrous bird calls, and it worked.
Lester glanced at his accomplice Smith, who was also shivering, though Lester could not tell if it was with fright or with the cold.
Lester's fears were unfounded. The freshly fallen snow and dug earth moved easily, and it wasn't long until the coffin was visible.
How do we get it out?
Lester asked, pointing to the grave at the coffin.
Are you daft, boy? You don't. We ain't after the coffin. We want what's inside it. That's why you brought a trunk.
Lester still looked confused as Smith used the back of the hammer to prise up the nails on the coffin lid.
But won't the body be all stiff-like? How will we fit it in the trunk?
Nah, the body goes all pliable-like after a couple of days. Don't you worry.
So it wasn't long until Lester was tasked with filling up the grave again, whilst Smith and Enoch folded the body into the trunk, making sure it was covered by the sawdust, and then bound and tied the trunk shut with thick cords.
Now we take this to that fool Carrington, said Enoch.
As the three of them arrived at Carrington's with the trunk, Lester and Smith carrying it, Enoch directing them with grunts and curses, Carrington attempted to proceed as if all was normal.
Good morning, gents. The early bird catches the worm, eh? Here, let me help you with that trunk.
Nah, they can manage,
Enoch spat. But Carrington wrestled with the trunk from Lester so that he could get a sense of its weight. He directed Smith to leave it.
What's in the trunk, then?
Nothing important,
Enoch spoke up again.
I don't believe we've been introduced. I'm Carrington. I run this carriage and wagon office,
he said, holding out his hand to be shook. Enoch waved his hand away.
I've no time for pleasantries.
Fair dues, but I'm in my rights to ask what you're wanting transported. You know that, and I will be satisfied before I allow it to be loaded onto the wagon.
Sawdust,
squeaked Smith. Enoch's face fell, crumpled like a screwed-up old rag. He slunk nearer to the door. He didn't like this one bit.
Well then, lad, why on earth would anyone be transporting sawdust in a trunk down to London at this time in the morning? Let's have a look at what's really in here, shall we?
Carrington produced a large knife for cutting the cords. Enoch snuck out of the door as soon as he saw the gleam of the blade. As the knife slipped through the first cord, Smith turned to run. His sudden movement shocked the constable, who darted after him, realising that the old cockney had also left. The constable blew his whistle and made off after Smith, calling out for others around him to take up the chase. Meanwhile, Maldon, the carpenter, grabbed Lester and held him tight, binding his wrists with a rope. Goldthorpe now joined Carrington in removing the cords that bound the trunk. Constable strode back through the door.
My men are in pursuit of Smith. They'll catch him, and that cockney fella as well. Here, let me see. I must witness this trunk being opened.
Lester was now silently weeping as the men crowded around the box. He'd come so close to getting away with it. They'd come so close to escaping. Now he could hear outside the townsfolk rousing, calling. A hue and cry was raised to find his accomplice Smith, his friend. But Smith had left him here. So had that old fella Enoch. As the men slowly lifted the lid and the constable leaned over, it appeared that the trunk was indeed full of sawdust, but after brushing to one end a few handfuls of the coarse wood shavings and dust, a foot emerged, and the sweet, cloying smell of death crept out into the wagon office. A young police officer struggled through the door sometime later with a cowering William Smith.
"They're after his blood, sir. All the town knows. And they'll tear them both to pieces if they can."
All could hear the mob outside Carrington's yard yelling and calling for the resurrectionist to be sent out to them. The constable shook his head. Determined to see the law respected, he bundled the two resurrection men onto one of Carrington's wagons. Choosing two of his fastest and strongest horses and sitting up with the driver, the constable made sure they had a hasty getaway to Bedford Jail, where the two Biggleswade labourers were admitted before trial. Meanwhile, unaware of the excitement at Carrington's wagon yard, Joseph Cooper trudged through the snow back to his father's grave. He found the grave disturbed, just as he had feared, and he fell to his knees, weeping for the first time since his father's passing. He was found a few minutes later by the vicar and given the news that his father's body was recovered and to be reinterred that very morning. The two dark figures stood out against the white of the snow, one man weeping, now with relief. The trial and aftermath. The trial of Lester and Smith was held during the last week of January in 1827 in Bedford. Cooper gave moving evidence of his two-day vigil at his father's graveside. The constable, Carrington, Maldon the carpenter, the ironmonger, and Rawlins the Catherine Wheels innkeeper all gave evidence. It was noted how hot feelings ran in the town against these resurrection men. But the law had no suitable sentence for such crimes. The theft of a body was classed as interference with a grave, which carried with it the lightest of sentences. Lester and Smith pleaded guilty and were sentenced to 3 months imprisonment in the new House of Correction and were fined £10 each. For those of you interested in prison history, Bedford has a rich history of jails and prisons. This new House of Correction was built in a hurry when the 1801 County Jail on Bromham Road, designed by the architect Vincent John Wing, was found too small for the rapid increase in prisoners during the first half of the 19th century. The new House of Correction did not last long, though, as it was eventually demolished in 1849 when the county jail was expanded. I have seen the ledger recording Lester and Wing's sentences, but sadly, it provides little more than their ages and details of crime and punishment. One thing we do know is that when released, these two young men did not resettle in Biggleswade. There is no record of them in the area at all after 1827. It is very likely that although not an official sentence as such, Biggleswade's anger and disgust at these young men, and probably their own shame, meant that they were effectively banished from their hometown. And what of the third man who escaped, the chap I named Enoch? Well, he was never caught. No suspect was ever named. It is probable that he was the fixer or broker for the transaction, or, in the case of my fictionalised story of it, tied to him. The body was destined to be dissected at a London University hospital, and although I'd like to think that Lester and Smith were Biggleswade homegrown criminal geniuses, all evidence suggests otherwise. They had to be middlemen. Neither lad had been in trouble with the law before, though Lester may have had a namesake cousin who was always in trouble, but we know that isn't our George Lester, as he was in prison at the time of the body snatching, and not of the right age either. It may just be a coincidence, and they're not related at all. Joseph Cooper was able to rebury his father that very day the resurrectionists were caught. Legacy. It fascinates me that this story has been remembered in the town for nearly 200 years, especially which aspects of the story have been remembered and which haven't, and where the tale has been embellished. The years have cast a murkier hue over the story. It's a vague tale that's remembered about gangs of body snatchers operating out of the Catherine Wheel pub and using the tunnels to transport the bodies. The Catherine Wheel pub was where the conspirators met, and Rawlins' witness testimony was important, but the tunnels are not mentioned at all in the contemporary sources. In fact, Smith is located hiding in a nearby garden shed to Carrington's yard when he is caught after running. Surely, if he was aware of the tunnels, he'd have used them to escape. But not mentioning the tunnels at the time doesn't mean that they weren't involved. It's just unlikely. What surprises me, though, is that this story is not remembered for what it actually is, which is a story about the townsfolk of Biggleswade triumphing over criminals. The carpenter, the ironmonger, and Carrington at the wagon yard all do their bit to assist in the capture of the resurrectionists. Cooper is a tragic but heroic figure, keeping vigil with a borrowed gun at the grave of his father. He's there for two whole days. I wonder if part of the reason this story isn't remembered quite as it happened is because some in the town were split in their feelings about what did go down. A large section of Biggleswade was angered by the resurrectionists, ready to, quote, tear them to pieces. But once it sunk in that these were two local lads, baptised at St Andrew's Church, the very churchyard robbed, maybe it all became a bit more complicated. I'm sure for some it wasn't. Some would have been just as resolute in despising these lads for their deeds, but others will have known them, cared for them, been friends with them, family to them. Maybe it's always easier to think that the criminals and wrongdoers come from outside the community, a shady gang from London using tunnels underground, rather than two of Biggleswade's own lads, who until this gruesome act had never been in trouble with the law. But I'd like to propose a new spin on this story, a more accurate take. I wish this story to be remembered like this, that Biggleswade's townfolk came together and prevented the body of old Thomas Cooper being snatched away for dissection. They acted as detectives, each thinking something was suspicious. They got their heads together and they alerted the authorities. Remember, this was before Bedfordshire Police existed. Police force would not be formed until another 12 years. The local constable needed all the help he could get. I haven't found any evidence of any other bodies being snatched from Biggleswade, and I can see why. The London brokers organising these thefts would think twice before going back to Biggleswade after being foiled by a carpenter, ironmonger, and wagon office man. Biggleswade should be proud that it foiled the gang and that it caught two local culprits, but especially proud that they prevented the body of Thomas Cooper being stolen away. Joseph and his family must have been so relieved and grateful. But what of the ghost stories? I am very grateful that those who used to work in the old Woolworths or Boots building have come forward to share their memories with me. The majority say that they didn't experience anything unsettling working there, but there is a handful who have reported uncanny goings on. The most common reports are of feelings of not being alone when out in the back stockroom by themselves. Feelings of unease or just uncomfortableness. There being an atmosphere near the window in the stockroom. But there has been little more reported than that. But these feelings of unease or a presence have in the past been linked to the tales of the Catherine Wheel being haunted by the body snatchers. One topic that always gets linked to the body snatchers and ghostly goings on is that of Biggleswade's tunnels. As I've mentioned before on the show, the buildings around Biggleswade Market Square and along the High Street have cellars, and most of these cellars include bricked up entrances. The bricking up of these entrances was in living memory, and some have shared stories about actually exploring the tunnels as children, reporting that they linked the cellars together and the tunnels ran quite far underground. Speculation is that these tunnels led to the church and to the river.
Although there are theories that the tunnels are not purpose-built, but instead remnants of older, longer cellars of the buildings destroyed in the Great Fire of 1786, which I covered in the Haunted Pound Stretcher and subsequent bonus episodes. I think it's probably a bit of both. There are tunnels and there are additional cellars. But a lot of people who have worked in the pubs and shops which have these now bricked up tunnel entrances have reported feeling deeply uncomfortable when near to them. We've heard reports of strange smells like cooking coming from them, strange atmospheres, and even shadowy figures being seen. I'll be sharing a video from one of these cellars on social media and the blog for you to have a look at. It's taken below the brilliant DD's Vegan Cafe. The cafe and the shop above, Lolabon, are definitely worth a visit when you're in Biggleswade. They sell dreamy cakes and gifts. DD's have been kind enough to let me go down into the cellar to explore, which I plan to do in April. And the cellar is entered through a trapdoor and a ladder. It's also worth noting that DD's is almost opposite where the Catherine Wheel pub once stood. But back to the body snatchers. It seems the tunnels have been associated with the body snatchers in more recent years, and I think the link is a logical one to make. The Catherine Wheel was rightly identified as the hangout of Lester and Smith and their shadowy companions before the raid on Cooper's grave. The Catherine Wheel pub has a large cellar which linked to the tunnels. The story of the body snatchers was shared at different times throughout the 20th century, along with curiosity about what the tunnels were for. So I can totally see why two and two were put together and five was made when it comes to the body snatchers and the use of the tunnels. There is no evidence that the resurrectionists used the tunnels, but we don't know that they didn't either. I suspect though that if they had used the tunnels and this was discovered, then it would have made the newspaper reports and court evidence. So although it makes sense to link the tunnels with the Resurrection Men and with the uncomfortable atmosphere in the cellars, I think we need to find another reason for why the tunnels or old cellars feel so uncomfortable. And I'll be tackling that in April after my visit to one of the cellars. If you believe that ghosts or paranormal experiences are caused by the spirits of the dead, I think it's unlikely that the tunnels or the shops or the site of the Catherine Wheel are haunted by anyone connected with the Resurrection Men. The body of Thomas Cooper was reburied straight away. The body snatchers themselves seem to have never returned to Biggleswade, so I can't imagine their spirits are haunting the town still. But what I think has definitely happened is that a crime was committed in Biggleswade that shocked the town to its core. The effect of the crime was to create fear, and maybe for some residents, a conflicted sense of shame if they were connected to the two lads who committed the grisly acts. As the years rolled on, the act of stealing a body was remembered, but some of the details slipped and shifted. The town forgot some of its own residents had been brave and had foiled the robbery. The crime became more shadowy, murky, outside gangs hiding in tunnels, smuggling the dead down to London. Their evil deeds lived on in explanations for feelings of uncomfortableness or fear in the back rooms and cellars of the site of where the Resurrection Men drank and plotted. I believe the women who have told me that they felt a presence with them in the stock rooms. I just don't think it was anything connected with the body snatchers, which leaves a bigger mystery for us to investigate in the future. Linking paranormal activity or feelings of unease to the body snatchers, I think, is an example of a history-driven haunting story rather than a phenomenon-driven one, and is another example of how crimes, particularly the most taboo of crimes, live on and mutate in our consciousness. Hauntings are associated with crimes because they are shocking and we hold on to them as a lesson to deter others, or because we feel there's still some unfinished business. The Resurrection Men were let off lightly, for one thing, with just 3 months' prison sentence. But sometimes hauntings associated with crimes are about the victims and our complicated feelings about how we remember victims and how we deal with crimes which go unpunished.
the Green Park Phantom fiddle player. On a bitterly cold day in January, I visited London's Green Park on the hunt for old ghosts. I also visited nearby Shepherd Market, which has a highwayman spectre, but maybe more on that in a future episode. Green Park and neighbouring St James's Park are probably my two favourite parks in London, and they're very different, but both have unusual ghost stories. As you'll hear on the recording I made while sitting in Green Park, I was in search of a ghost and a terrifying tree. It was dusk, and I was bundled up in a winter coat, hat and scarf. The recording opens with geese flying overhead. There's a lot of wildlife in London's park, as you'll hear. Some of it with its own myths and legends. It's a cold January evening, and I'm sitting in Green Park in London. And if you've never been to Green Park, it's between Buckingham Palace and Piccadilly, and it's a big open green space with lots of trees. No formal flower beds, but during the spring there are lots of daffodils. So one of the rumours that I've read about Green Park is that no flower will grow here. But that's not true, because I have photographs of the swathes of daffodils that definitely grow here in the spring. It's about 4:30, not quite 4:30, about 4:15 in the afternoon, and the sun is about to set in about 15 minutes time. And the park is still busy, lots of people making their way from one part of London to the other. It really is a kind of thoroughfare. At this time of year, Green Park is a place that people go through rather than visiting in itself. But in the summer, there are deck chairs and people sitting out and enjoying the sun. It has sort of crisscrossing paths running through it. Everyone walking past is bundled up in big thick coats and scarves and hats because it is really, really bitterly cold today. There's something of the video game Bloodborne to this park. I think it's the lamps. It's got old-fashioned Victorian lamps, iron railings, big, tall, twisty trees. And at this time of night, with the sunset being a kind of orangey-yellow colour, it really gives off those kind of Bloodborne vibes. It's probably one of the reasons why I like it. It's quite a gothic park. But today I came here in search of two things. One is a tree known as the Death Tree. And the story goes that no bird will rest on a branch on that tree. No bird will forage for food underneath that tree. There's a magpie. But also that apparently homeless people who sleep in the park will shun that tree. There are a number of legends about what has happened to people who have been foolhardy enough to sleep beneath that tree, including a really bizarre story about a sort of half-pig, half-woman cryptid. Now, I found an earlier version of this story which claims that the Death Tree is actually in St James's Park, which is just over the road from here. So I'm not sure whether it really is in Green Park or whether it is over in St James's Park. But I think Green Park's a better contender just because there's more trees here. Now, the reason why there is a Death Tree, it is said, is because Green Park was built on the site of a hospital for people with leprosy in medieval times. So I'm going to look into that and find out whether that is true. Is there any truth in that? Or was this a burial ground? That's the other rumour, that this park was built on a burial ground. So I had a look around at the trees and I've taken lots of photographs that you'll be able to see on the podcast blog, weirdinthewade.blog. And I haven't really found one that would be a contender. The trees here are beautiful. There is one tree which is fenced off, and I had high hopes as I approached it because it was glowing a kind of ghostly red in the sunset, and it looked like it had growths on it. But as I got closer, there was a plaque written at the bottom of the railings, and the plaque said that the tree had been planted to commemorate Queen Mary and
King George's wedding, I think. So I'm guessing that was about 100 years ago, at least. I'll have to go back and have a look and brush up on my British royal history. But I'm guessing we're talking at least 100 years ago that that tree was planted, if it was Queen Mary and King George. So I don't think that could be the death tree. The other interesting thing now, in not just Green Park, but many of the parks in London, is that there are, as well as the magpies that you can hear, parakeets. Green parakeets. There's a lot of rumour and mystery around how these parakeets ended up in the London parks. One of the stories is they escaped from a film set, Errol Flynn film set, but apparently that's not true, which is a shame because it's such a great story. I think it's one of his pirate films, and they had some green parakeets that escaped. I used to see them in my garden in Catford, and back then, 20 years ago, they hadn't quite colonised the centre of London, but now they seem to be everywhere and moving steadily north. I really love them. They're very gregarious and noisy, and they're great fun to watch. But obviously they do compete with our native birds. There is one other story about Green Park that I've read. I'm sure I will find more, but the other story that I came here today to think about is the story of a phantom who plays a fiddle. He's a violinist, and the story goes that he used to busk in the park maybe 150, 200 years ago. But one day he fell asleep, and in some of the stories it says he fell asleep under the death tree, which you must never do. And when he awoke, someone had stolen his fiddle. And obviously that instrument was his livelihood. And anyone who plays an instrument will know how heartbreaking it would be for someone to steal your instrument. But for him, doubly so, because this was how he made a living and he couldn't afford to buy a new fiddle. So the story goes that he searched the park for weeks and weeks, asking people, "Have you seen my violin? Do you know anything about it?" But he never found his violin, and no one was ever caught for stealing it. Now, some accounts say that he just died of a broken heart. Others say that he took his own life because he was so distraught at the loss of his income and the loss of his beloved instrument. But in death, he was reunited with a ghostly fiddle. And on dark winter's nights, or late into the evening in the summer, you can hear him playing his violin. So if anyone listening plays the fiddle and fancy a bit of busking, Green Park's the place to come and do it. You might just scare a few people in the know. So I'm going to sit here for a bit longer and just sort of take in the ambience of the park.
Conclusions. I think I'll revisit the death tree of Green Park in a future episode, so if anyone listening knows anything about the story, please do get in touch. Green Park does have a peculiar atmosphere of its own. Peter Underwood, the renowned expert in all things ghostly, described its stillness, an air of expectancy, and a sensation of sadness. I might describe it as both sombre and yet gothic at the same time. It seems that the rumours of Green Park being built on the site of a burial ground could hold some truth. St James's Hospital for Lepers, run by monks, was on the site until the dissolution of the monasteries in the 16th century by Henry VIII. I'm surprised there aren't more sightings of spectral monks. The land was swampy, and part of it was used as a brickworks as well. But it was Charles II who acquired the land for a garden and enclosed it in the 1680s. Charles II kept an ice house in the garden for keeping his royal drinks nicely cooled. Throughout the 18th century, it was known as a rather shady area of London, literally and metaphorically, the haunt of highwaymen and duelists. It wasn't until 1820 that the park was landscaped by John Nash. I found a letter written in the London Chronicle in 1840, despairing at plans to convert Green Park into more formal gardens. The letter writer does not object to a few more trees being planted for the pleasure of those who live 100 years hence, but does object to taming this beautiful spot. And I'm glad the plans for making formal gardens did not go ahead, as almost 200 years later, Green Park still is an unusual and beautiful feature within London, full of beautiful old trees. Although the story of the ghostly violinist appears in collections of ghost stories for London and is included in some London ghost walks, I can't find an origin for the story. I tried to find any reports of it in newspapers, and also I looked into unusual deaths or thefts reported in Green Park, but could find nothing obvious. There is much more digging to do. But hearing ghostly music, especially from violins, is common in many ghost stories and folk tales. In fact, the next episode of the podcast is about a phantom violinist. More on that later. There were definitely deaths within Green Park over the years. Duels were held in the park. There were robberies too, and sadly, it was associated with suicides. So it doesn't seem that surprising that an ancient site like Green Park, with its solemn trees and baleful atmosphere, attracts so many strange stories, including the one of the phantom violinist. Victims of crime. And finally, it's another case relating to a crime. In this case, a victim of crime. A spirit found repeating behaviour he performed in life, the playing of his music, and in some versions, his spectre still approaches people, asking them if they have seen his violin. There's a lot of complicated reasons for stories like this to be remembered. They're a warning to the young and unwary to keep their belongings safe, don't let your violin or work tools be stolen. A warning to not sleep rough in the park, to be careful in the park after dark. It's a warning to the criminal and the community who frequent the park, that crime leads to restless spirits, that crimes like theft have wider consequences. There's that fear that those wronged in life cannot move on, cannot rest nor find peace. There's also something of preserving the memory of this poor young man. If the theft had not happened, no one would remember him today. He is defined by that theft of his instrument, but by that he lives on forever. Victims of crime haunt us quite literally when as a community we can't give them justice, and maybe that haunts us through the stories we tell about them. Our collective guilt won't let them rest. Next time on Weird in the Wait will be the first Weird Wonders episode. You should see a slightly different podcast artwork and hear a remixed theme at the start. Don't worry, standard Weird in the Wade episodes are still going to happen every month. Weird Wonders episodes are extra. They'll cover stories that are geographically further away from Biggleswade and explore different themes tied to history and the paranormal. In the first Weird Wonder, we only travel just over the county border into Hertfordshire as I tell the story of Blind George, the fiddle player, who haunts the village of Anstey. It also gives me an opportunity to explore blindness in myth, folklore, and the paranormal. As you probably know, I'm visually impaired, and in the next episode, I speak with a friend of mine who is blind. Fans of Uncanny might know that the show's catchphrase, "I know what I saw," but what if you don't see or know not to trust what you see because you know how unreliable human senses really are? We'll also discuss a common neurological condition that affects blind people and could hold the answer to at least some ghost sightings. I'm really looking forward to this episode, and it should be released on Easter Monday as a special Easter treat. You can listen as you wallow in chocolate. Thank you so much for listening to Weird in the Wade. I have some special thank yous to say before I go. I'd like to thank Trudy, Abby, Fiona, Leslie, Anthony, John, and Julie. Thank you so much for your support through buying the show a coffee or two on Ko-fi. It really means a lot to me, and it keeps the show's running costs more manageable.
Remember, put the 1st of May at 7 p.m. BST, that's British summertime, in your diaries for what will be a live YouTube stream where I'll share stories about my stay in the haunted apartment and pub, as well as answering any questions you have about the podcast and the stories I've covered so far. You can find Weird in the Wade on YouTube. There's a link in the show description. Also, if you'd like to submit a question in advance, then you can do so either on social media or email the show at weirdinthewade@gmail.com. In fact, email if you have any questions or any suggestions or ideas that you want to share. Weird in the Wade is researched, written, produced and presented by me, Nat Doig. The theme music is by Tess Savagier. All other music and additional sound effects are from Epidemic Sound.